today we're continuing our talk series called Identity Crisis. And what the series is all about is God has a specific character, and we find who we are by comparing our character to his. Because until we recognize that we are created in the image of God, the image of God's character, we suffer from an identity crisis. As we learn about the characteristics of God, we begin to understand who we were created to be. And last week, Carrie covered God's character of grace. What this is speaking of, it's whereby God does not concern himself with our worthiness. Rather, he focuses on exercising love and achieving the best outcome with whoever he comes across, with the best results coming from our imitation of his grace of our own accord, letting God's grace live through us, not concerning ourselves with the worthiness of someone, but rather what is the best for them in this situation, and letting the idea of do they deserve it or not depart from your mind. So I'm not out of the intro yet, but I'm still going to start with the Hebrew early. Everybody say chata. Chata. K-H-A-T-A. Chata. Aside from being the noise Bruce Lee makes when he backhands somebody at 95 miles an hour, this is actually the Hebrew word for sin. And like everything in Hebrew, it does not take a direct route. It literally means to miss. Specifically, to miss with an arrow fired at a target. So chata, instead of just saying sin, they mean to miss. It doesn't even bring a connotation of good or evil. It's an objective that you can pass or fail. I love that because it's very different from our perception of the word sin. It is an analogy of the philosophical goal of ancient Israel. The target is for each individual to obtain God's character while retaining their own individuality. Missing this character is a chata. It's a miss. You were trying to be like God, but you missed. And if there's a bend in yourself, if there's a bend in your arrow that's going to cause you to miss, that is known as an evon. That's easier than chata. It's also not as funny. Evon is where we get our word iniquity. It's something that's not equal. It's something that has bent your arrow, and it causes you a miss. And it's a reference to psychoses that will lead you to different sins and make you miss God's character. Now, this is all a discussion for another day. I'd love to unpack it. But the reason I'm bringing it up is a brief stop on these concepts. It paints the importance of studying God's character, of studying who God the Father actually is, because our goal is his character. And to get into that character, we're going to go into the description of God. Exodus chapter 34, 6 through 7. This is the verse that we've been leaning on as a descriptor of God. And the reason being, this is actually part of a daily prayer that the ancient Hebrews went through. And again, if you repeat, Carrie brings this up, repeat, repeat, repeat. In the Old Testament, it's because you need to know it. And it's a daily prayer that constantly reminded them who God is and who they're trying to be. Yahweh, Yahweh, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, overflowing with loyal love and faithfulness. So this week we're going to be covering the slow to anger portion because I'm a glutton for punishment. Now, this idea is pretty well in the name, slow to anger. Self-explanatory, right? All right, close your books, go to lunch. You know, easy. There's a bit more to it than that. There's a bit more to it than, you know, somebody who doesn't fly off the handle after a lot of time, or until a lot of time has passed and a great amount of frustration has been sustained. You know, somebody who takes the punishment. There's a bit more to it than that. It might be more accurate to say slow to act upon your anger, or acting upon your anger with intentionality, not with self-interest. And so to get into what the Old Testament describes this as, I think it's very important that we talk about noses. Did everybody bring their nose today? Yes? Erech apayim. This is the Hebrew term for slow to anger. When you read slow to anger in your Bible, it was originally erech apayim. It does not mean slow to anger. It means to be long of the nose. Here, let's get the full appreciation of this. Yahweh, Yahweh, compassionate and gracious, long of the nose, overflowing with loyal love and faithfulness. That kind of sticks out to me, pardon the pun. So what the analogy is, so you know how when people get into an argument, specifically guys, they'll just sit there and they're like, jar, jar. They'll just go at each other like a couple of badgers frothing at the mouth and their faces will turn red. Well, evidently in ancient times, a particular part of your face would turn red first. And it was noticeable, like blood would rush to their nose and it would get hot and red. And that was their analogy for anger. So, if you don't fly off the handle too readily, you must be long of the nose. You don't get angry that quick. I just love that. So, getting into scripture, let's see where God had a long nose. Now, we've been visiting the situation in Exodus 32, where Moses is on the mountain talking to God. The people, they get impatient and they get scared, and so they decide to create a God for themselves that's more familiar and also more associated with their own prosperity and security rather than interest in others and interest in God's character. And we've been covering this as a means and as a very good example of God demonstrating his character. He demonstrates his character all throughout this passage, one after the other. But starting in Exodus chapter 32, verse 9, God's speaking to Moses on top of the mountain after seeing the situation at the bottom of the mountain. I've seen these people, the Lord said to Moses, and they are a stiff-necked people. Now leave me alone so I can turn my anger that it may burn against them and that I might destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation. So I'm done with this. I'm just going to wipe them out and start over with you somehow in the desert. But Moses sought the favor of God. Lord, he said, why should you turn your anger against your people, whom you brought out of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians say, it was with evil intent that he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger, relent, and do not bring disaster on your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, to whom you swore by your own self, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky, and I will give your descendants all this land I promised them, and it will be their inheritance forever. Then the Lord relented and did not bring on his people the disaster he had threatened. For continuing, just want to point out, with all these sentences of description, all it says is the Lord relented. Not another word, not another plea. He simply did. First thing. I'm going to skip ahead to verse 27. Moses is at the bottom of the mountain on verse 27. He just saw what was going on, and he broke the tablets of God's laws on the ground. And then he said to them, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Each man strap a sword to his side. Go back and forth throughout the camp from one end to the other, each killing his brother and friend and neighbor. Then the Levites did as Moses commanded, and that day about 3,000 people died. Then Moses said, you've been set apart for the Lord today, for you were against your own sons and brothers, and he has blessed you this day. It's kind of an uncomfortable passage, isn't it? Well, let's park on this. Did God ask Moses to have people strap swords on? And don't take my word for it. Go and read the passages from verses 15 to 26. God did not ask Moses to do that. Nor did God ask Moses to break the tablets on the ground. And the fact that God was a little upset that Moses had done so should probably tell you God's intent. Was this the first time Moses acted on a short nose? No. He actually, the entire reason he's leading people out of Egypt is because he flew off the handle and 86'd someone. That was not approved of either. And so I won't get into the potential controversy of whether or not, you know, God approved a killing spree, but I'm just pointing out, God had relented. It said, I relented. It did not say, okay, I'll narrow it to about 3,000 or so. It was not a negotiation. God scared Moses, Moses pleaded, and God relented because he loves. At one request, he relented. The character difference between the two is demonstrated readily. Obviously, God's not beyond smiting something, but it's also obviously not his go-to method. In this story, we see how willing God is to withhold his anger compared to Moses, who absolutely lost it as soon as he got to the bottom of the mountain. And I consider that absolutely ironic. God told him what was going on. But on top of the mountain, he's like, whoa, whoa, wait. But then when he gets down and sees it himself, he just goes berserk. It's different when you see it, right? I mean, you hear about stuff on the news, and we're all like that. I'm like, oh, that's awful. That's so bad. And then you do nothing about it. But if you're there in person on ground zero, you're a bit more animate, right? We're emotive creatures. We can be filled with emotion. We can get hot noses. But God doesn't have that problem. And Exodus, it continues all throughout the book. Story after story of God withholding his anger despite the people he's protecting grumbling against him. And I'm going to go off on a tangent here. There's actually another story, and I'll paraphrase so I can get through it quickly. But there's another story where the Israelites are camped in a valley, and there's this enemy king who feels threatened by him. This is the king of Moab, and he has the opportunity to be nice to them and ally with them. He has the opportunity to, you know, go with God. Nobody's coming to conquer him yet, but no, instead, he decides to hire this wizard, witch doctor guy, and bring him up on top of this mountain and say, shout curses upon them so that, you know, they will be destroyed. And this wizard goes to say not nice things about him. His name is Balaam. He just goes to say not nice things, and he can't. Every time he's supposed to curse them, he winds up saying these wonderful things and blessings and, you know, may their camels never have hot noses and whatnot. And, you know, he can't. And in the meantime, down in the valley, they're grumbling about the food and the location and the heat. God's people are complaining about him. And on top of a mountain, he's blessing them. It's a great story of patience, and I never really captured the moral of the story because there's a part of the story where the wizard's donkey talks to him and it kind of derails your attention. But time after time in this desert, God's faithful to them despite their grumbling. It's patience. It's a cold nose. Ooh, dogs have cold noses. That explains a lot. That's why they're so sweet. Their noses don't get hot. Aww. I'm checking to see if my daughter's making a face. She is. So there's a tension when we talk about God's anger. We don't like talking about God, you know, coming to the end of the rope and saying, okay, time for a plague, right? We don't like it when God gets to the end of his nose. Most of us know that God's purpose is love, that God himself is love, but love's nature is grace and justice. Grace in and of itself is not fair. It's an injustice. Give grace to someone who just intends to go on making life miserable for everyone else. That's injustice to the people who are considering the fellow humans. You can make peace with a person, but you can't make peace with a problem. A line must be drawn somewhere. And picking up where we left off last week, we were talking about grace, but grace has a line. the gavel must come down sometime. And God's anger and discipline has a purpose. You see, it is anger that burns, his anger, when we settle for something less than his character. His anger itself is an act of love, compassion, grace, and faithfulness. You see, in the Old Testament, God is, in their minds, the author of order. In Genesis, the world is tohu va-fohu. That means wild and wasted. It is barren. It is dark. There's nothing good in it, and God orders it. He brings something out of it. He creates. God's way is the preservation of good. It's the preservation of order. The enactment of his anger, if you notice, every time, every instance in the Old Testament where God enacts his anger, all he's doing is handing people over to this disorder that they're choosing. You have God in his way, and his way is to be of a selfless character. His way is to put others first in everything you do, work to assist and love others, and don't worry about your survival. You know, justice is mine, says the Lord. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. I will go before you and win the day for you. You're not to worry about threats to your person. You're just to worry about taking care of everyone else and loving God as family because he loves you back so much. This is God's way. But when we choose to take it in our own hands, when we choose to try and dominate each other, all God does is hand you over to that. You want to try and dominate other people? Fine. You get to deal with the other people who are also trying to dominate other people. You want to be in a competition? Fine. I'm going to put you against the bigger fish. I'm going to put you against Babylon. You want to compete with other nations? You're going to find one that's bigger than you, and you're going to lose. That doesn't work. But when you love the alien, the foreigner, the widow, the poor, we take care of each other. If we're all worried about each other, we don't have to worry about ourselves. So choosing competition, choosing survival of the fittest, God's anger is simply handing you over to that. I'm giving you what you chose. You wanted to try it yourself, so go for it yourself. But if you want to come back and have God take care of you instead, you're welcome to do so. In all the uncomfortable Old Testament stories of God angers, we remember the unpleasant end of the story, but we also forget about the incredible amounts of time that pass while he's being patient. Incredible amounts of time before his anger is enacted. Speaking of time, I need to check it. Genesis 15. This is kind of a random verse to bring in here in this conversation, but we'll make it work. Starting in verse 13. Then the Lord said to him, Abraham, this is when God is speaking to Abraham about the future of his nation, long before Israel and Egypt. The Lord said to him, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation that they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation of your descendants, they will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites is not yet reached its full measure. So God's promise to Abraham, that's also pertinent to previous conversation. Moses brought it up when he asked God to relent. He's like, well, these are Abraham's children. God's like, yep, liked Abraham. I'll do it as a favor to him. But I'd like to focus on verse 16. I remember when I was young being absolutely intrigued by verse 16. It's subtle and it's fantastic. It's not cut and dry, wrath versus love. I don't know what the Amorites did. I don't know what they were like. I don't know if they, you know, sent wizards to stand on top of mountains and shout curses. May your frogs have hot noses. Do frogs have noses? Don't answer that. I don't know what the Amorites were like, but God was practicing patience with the Amorites. He specifically told Abraham, hey, don't let your descendants go and conquer the Amorites, okay? Their sin hasn't reached its full measure. And that just bothered me. I parked on it, and I thought about it nonstop. And I see now that the reason is God knew one day the Amorites would be a lost cause, but he wasn't going to act on his anger until they had no hope. Abraham's children couldn't have the land because the Amorites were not yet beyond hope. God was withholding anger. It was not his go-to. This was, what, at least 440 years? Probably would have been 400, but we had to send 12 spies in and get upset, and they might be giants. We act on anger impulsively because we feel it, usually in our self-interest. God acts on anger with intentionality because all courses to reconciliation or separation with God or from God, they're final. And his anger consists of giving exactly what is being asked of him, disorder for disorder and evil for evil. And just can't restate it enough, God's anger is meant to be for our benefit because he doesn't get angry because you've personally offended him. He gets angry when you are settling for less than what you were meant to be. He gets angry when you choose this survival of the fittest mentality rather than self-giving love. So I talked a lot about the Old Testament, but I like to jump the gap to the other side of the exile. What about Jesus? We talked about God demonstrating a long nose in the Old Testament. What about Jesus? Did he have a long nose? I'm going to hit that analogy so many times. Let's see. Well, Jesus being slow to anger. Okay. Who'd Jesus get angry at? Jesus got angry at demons. What was his response to that? What was it like? Yeah, put them in the pigs. I'd like to add that to American law. What was this, 450 parking violations? Put them in the pigs. Yeah, so Jesus responding to demons, I noticed, you know, these interactions, they're oddly polite. Like, this thing's frothing at the mouth, throwing people, contorting them, you know, throwing Roman centurions through a window and whatnot. And Jesus walks up, what's your name? I don't know, throw me in the pigs? And it's an oddly polite interaction. And this is something Jesus is dead set against, but slow to anger. He simply takes care of business and moves on. He's composed. Let's see, who else did Jesus get mad at? The disciples. Have you ever had to explain something to someone perfectly lucid over and over and over and over? The fact that we don't get, oh man, you said it and you said it. we don't get a passage where it's like, oh, Jesus threw up his hands and stormed off. No, he kept going. And mind you, what you read in the Bible was the end product where they finally got it. It doesn't cover the 360 other times that he was talking to the disciples about this. It is, you know, somebody showed up 45 years after crucifixion. Hey, Mark, how do you explain that? Oh, okay, when we finally got it, it's like 3 months after covering it. How about when the disciples, those Jesus was training to lead a kingdom of self-giving love, start arguing about which one's the better disciple. And then, another time, and then they start arguing about who's going to have a bigger chair in heaven. Really? Love the poor. Hey, what jewels are you going to have on your chair? Yeah, mine are going to be bigger. I mean, really? Jesus had a lot of patience with, and this is those closest to him. He had a lot of patience with the disciples. I can only imagine the anger that must have been, you know, teased out from the world in general and the injustice he saw at large. Didn't have this in my notes, but also want to put Pharisees and Sadducees, the keepers of the law, constantly, literally harassing him, trying to get him to say something wrong. And rather than react in anger, he simply used their own scriptures and maneuvered it into getting them to question why they even observe their own laws and, you know, throwing out there in front of them, this is why we have that, trying to get them to understand the intent rather than the letter instead of getting angry with them. Constantly harassed, and instead of, you know, burning the nose, he gave them the true meaning behind the law that they were trying to enforce. A lot of patience. But the best example I have for long noses in the New Testament, that's the name of a YouTube video. The best one is a whopper. Jesus chasing people out of the temple in Jerusalem with a whip. Sorry, the whip. It's a chata whip. I'm going to whip your chata because of my erek apayim. John 2, chapter, verse 13. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. Verse 15. So he made a whip out of cords and drove all of the temple, or all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for my house will consume me." Uh-oh. So this is Jesus being impatient, right? This is an ugly display of anger, right? We got to call the whole thing off. You know, we can't follow somebody who, you know, chases people with chata whips, right? Okay. Three things. I might come up with four before I'm done talking. Who knows? One, Jesus has been coming to this place for 30 years while this is going on. That's patience. I have not been patient with anything for 30 days, much less 30 years, right? He's been seeing this for 30 years. Two, the purpose of the temple, both symbolically and literally, the purpose of the temple is to reconcile humanity to their God in an effort to restore God's family. God loves you like family. That is why he's seeking reconciliation. That's why there's a word, shalom. I'm getting off into the weeds here, sorry. God's seeking reconciliation, and that's what the temple is for. And the law, the Hebrew law, had caveats to allow everyone in the temple, including foreigners, widows, and the poor. Now, if someone has made a business out of the temple and the sacrifices and what room you can get into, it would no doubt keep the poor or the unfortunate out. It was an exclusionary reconciliation. Only the rich can be made right with God. Kind of gets you boiling, right? Three, it was a corded whip, not a sword. Not 3,000 swords strapped to the hip going back and forth. It was a whip. It wasn't a cat of nine tails. It was a corded whip. This is for discipline and driving out livestock. That's literally what these whips were for. And it actually, when the verse talks about him driving with a whip, it talks about sheep and cattle. It doesn't even specifically say he was going after people. Because frankly, if I went after someone with a whip, I don't think they'd take me seriously. I think everybody watching me do it would laugh about it, and the person I was driving would be like, "No, stop, man." And it's kind of a Charlie Brown situation. But it was a whip and not a sword. It was discipline and not angst. for 30 plus years, they had a chance to stop this practice that kept God's family from being reconciled. It was a practice that was separating God from people he loved. And he tolerated it, not just for 30 years. Bad practices in the temple, you know, happened for long before that. Habits evolve. So what about us? I mean, we've covered God having a long nose in the Old Testament. We covered Jesus having a long nose in the New Testament. And it's a character we need to imitate. We need to be patient, and it doesn't say do not get angry. Matter of fact, I'm getting ahead of myself. Ephesians 4, in your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold. This verse is placed amongst a lot of instructions for the new and fledgling church in Ephesus. But this one sticks out in this conversation because anger and sin are separated. This is something I struggled with a lot when I was little. I thought any time I was angry, I was wrong. And so with anger came guilt. And when you feel guilty about an emotion you can't help, you get more anger. So anger led to guilt, led to anger. No, anger and sin are separate. If you are wronged, you're going to emote. It's not a voluntary action. The difference is one is a feeling and one is the action taken on said feeling. So being slow to anger is more than just don't get angry so quick. It's knowing how to use said anger. If you're lashing out in your self-interest, you know, how dare they, or I'm going to take this back, that is you and that is sin. That is missing God's character. It's a chata. But if you get angry for someone, like they lost their house through somebody else cheating, that's not right. You're not going to go after the cheater. You're going to go help whoever lost their house. You're not going to go after the offender. You're going to help the offended. And yes, we get a lot of ugly stories in the Old Testament of seemingly like God's going after the offender, but what God is doing is an intention. He's steering people from a path of destruction to a path of life through correction. Grace, love, compassion, these are all vehicles to help everyone to choose life, to choose God's family. But when it comes to wrongdoing, you have to go through correction. And to have correction, you have to taste the anger. I'm going to hit another verse, James chapter 1, starting verse 19. This is a verse my lovely wife gave me, and I'm very appreciative of it because it provided me the perfect closing to this. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen and slow to speak. And slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. My ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. We get angry over personal offenses. God gets angry because something is in our way of being better. We frequently experience anger by simply reacting to something that has adversely affected us. God only acts on anger with intent in serving justice and grace as concepts themselves. And he does it for our benefit. Reactionality versus intentionality. You see, being angry over our investments versus being angry over what is right and acting with everyone's best interest, no matter how angry you feel, that is growing your nose. But I'm a real boy. You knew I had to go there. You knew I had to go there. So, where does that leave us? Let's see. Thus far in this series, we've covered compassion, grace, and slow to anger. compassion, it's fairly easy conclusion to arrive to. You know, God is love, so we need to, you know, extend ourselves out to practice such. Grace, a bit harder to swallow because that's giving somebody something they don't deserve. But they need it. That's where your character starts to build. But they need it. And slow to anger. Being careful with what you do when you're angry, and specifically, being mindful of what makes you angry. That's the key. Simply being mindful of what makes you angry. Like somebody took my coffee. Dangerous if you do this to me, by the way. I don't care what I said this morning. My coffee. But need to water my nose. I totally derailed with that comment. I apologize. But acting with intentionality, sorry, and just being mindful of what makes you angry. You will get angry because of personal offenses, but when you analyze it under grace, you see, yes, this person offended me, but acting against them is not something they need. That's not gracious. The proper way to grow your nose and be slow to anger is to, oh, I see an injustice that makes me angry, but I don't have to act on the negative inflection of that. I can move to correct it, not respond to it. I can move to fix, to bring it to completeness, wholeness, shalom. I could try to make peace. I could try to alleviate the suffering. But lashing out is where you need to draw the line in the sand. And I realize I talked about God's anger. It's not a comfortable subject because we've kind of been conditioned. You know, God is supposed to be, you know, the God of K-love. This anger stuff, it's kind of heavy metal. You know, put the sword on your hip, back and forth. Hot nose, heavy metal. But God is not just the God of K-love. He's the God of every single thing he's had to put humanity through in order to guide humanity to something that's selfless and something of social justice rather than our tribe versus their tribe versus their tribe versus that organization versus that political party versus that sports team versus anybody who likes that style of music, so on and so on forth. But it's uncomfortable to talk about God's anger, but it is in love, and that is what we must keep in mind. It is in love, and remember those Amorites, it's never poured out. God's anger is never poured out if there's any other choice. And so I'm going to just invite everybody to bow their heads. You know, we talk about these uncomfortable subjects. We talk about matters of God that we may, you know, have some friction with God on, but I'm neither qualified nor energetic enough to just walk anybody through potential conflicts with God. But I would simply invite everybody in this moment, just pray to God, and if you have any friction with him, anything that you disagree with him on, or any concept that you struggle with, an idea of something God does or something God might state or expect, that you just don't understand why he would want that. You don't understand how a good God could allow a particular thing or how a good God could ask a particular thing. I challenge you and I invite you right now with your head bowed, just pray and take it up with him. I mean, God is not small. God is not unprepared, and God is not surprised by just any beef you have with him. God has a long nose. And so I just invite you right now, take advantage of that. Just talk to God, and if you have any issue with him, just bring it to him now. if you don't have an issue with God, but you have something in your life that is bothering you, something that causes you worry, something that causes you anger, or something that causes you guilt, bring that too. It's a specialty. I mean, God sent Jesus specifically for this reconciliation. And Jesus chased people out of the temple specifically because that reconciliation was his entire mission. In the Old Testament, that reconciliation was a ceremony, an action that showed, God, I want to be right with you. God, I want to be in your family again. I want to trust you. I don't want to be selfless. I want to follow your way. And not a way that's in my own self-interest and my own securities. And in the New Testament, Jesus did the exact same. Except instead of a ceremony, he provided an example. Jesus, despite doing nothing wrong, he allowed other people's chata to engulf him. He allowed other people's chata to punish him for no reason. And then the ultimate display of being slow to anger, he allowed himself to be hung on a cross after being tortured, humiliated, and lied against, and full well having the power to wipe the slate and start over. He didn't. He just let it happen. See, I see this as the ultimate shock absorption. I see this as all the sin being brought down on Jesus, and instead of Jesus doing what any other person would do and responding to the sin and rebounding it and striking back, lashing out, he absorbed it. Why? Because lashing out in anger against the wrongs that were clearly done to him when he was in the right, that's not what we needed. That wasn't in the interest of us. That would have been in the interest of himself because he was wronged. But instead, he looked at it, analyzed it, looked up to the sky and said, Father, forgive them because they don't know what they're doing. He had every right to lash out, but he didn't. He looked at the situation and said, they don't know. And justice is not what they need right now. They need grace. So he just absorbed that sin. He took the hit. He absorbed the shock. All that wrath hit him, and he didn't respond with wrath. The epitome of being slow to anger and compassionate and faithful and with loyal love, because Jesus, taking that sacrifice, well, I was told to Abraham a long time ago, and he kept the promise. And if you're struggling with any of this that I've said, if you're struggling with anything else, if you're struggling with any concept of how you deal with God or deal with others on behalf of God, right now I invite you to just talk to Jesus. Ask him what to do about it. Ask him to show you the answers. Just hand it over to him. Invite him to take care of your securities. Invite him to take care of your future. And just invite him to your life such that you can worry about others. So that you can keep the mindset of what people need rather than what they deserve. Exercising grace and being slow to anger. Jesus, we thank you for this day and everything you've provided for us. We thank you for this opportunity to have the hard conversations with you. We thank you for being oh so slow to anger on the cross. It was our sin and our competing with each other and our competing with you that put you there when you didn't deserve it and did nothing to ask for it. But you forgave us, and then you asked God to forgive us. And Lord, I pray that you'll just come into all of our lives. Pray that you'll take control. Pray that you'll provide for us the security and establish our future and just help us to achieve your character and to love others as you do. We pray that you just take control. And we invite you here right now.